Big Science, Environmental Ethics, and Public Policy, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Philosopher Tom Reagan of North Carolina State University is here to talk about the environment and social values. Before that, historian Robert Smith of the Johns Hopkins University and the Smithsonian Institution discusses large-scale science and public policy.
At what point does it become prohibitively expensive to expend the resources necessary to build and operate the instruments of big science? The point at which its gains become less cost-effective than the gains that can be achieved with a large number of small-scale projects. The trend in particle physics and astronomy is toward ever larger and more sophisticated scientific tools to probe smaller and more distant regions. And scientists have secured impressive results through the access provided by big science tools to previously inaccessible phenomena. But does this development always make scientific sense?
Historian Robert Smith, he'll be back in just a moment to talk about large-scale science and public policy. Later on the program this week, philosopher Tom Reagan will be here to discuss ecoholism and the environment. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Last September, NASA put astronauts into orbit to check equipment and perform a spacewalk in preparation for another mission scheduled for December of this year to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. Like the space program itself, the Hubble project cost hundreds of millions of dollars. But because of flaws that scientists weren't aware of until it was placed in orbit, it embodies the technical and financial pitfalls that seem to plague many of the large-scale scientific projects underwritten by the federal government. But assuming that astronauts can repair it, what about its scientific as well as social rewards? From the perspective of an historian of science, questions like that are of special interest to one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Robert Smith is a professor of history at the Johns Hopkins University and a research associate of the Smithsonian Institution. He's at work on an account of large-scale scientific projects, from the time of late medieval and Renaissance stargazers through the Hubble telescope itself. Here's Robert Smith.
Well, it's in orbit. It's about 380 miles up, and it's producing scientific results. It's producing lots of scientific papers from the data it's collecting. The interesting thing with the Hubble, though, is the repair mission, which is currently scheduled for late 1993 or early 1994, the idea being that astronauts will go up on the shuttle. They will do a number of things to the telescope, replace some of the modules on the telescope, insert new modules, change out instruments, insert new instruments. And the idea is that with these fixes, as NASA engineers would call them, the telescope's capability should be vastly improved and should be much closer to the original promise of the telescope's abilities.
All right, now, any project in big science, I take it, is going to have a lengthy and a complex, if not a troubled, history. Before our taping session, you gave me a piece to read that you wrote for the LA Times, and accompanying that piece is a little cartoon here. It's basically a big black block, and it says, one picture is worth $1.5 billion. My question to you, therefore, is how do we figure out what is and is not a scientific boondoggle when we use this term, big science?
Well, I think it's interesting that before the launch of the space telescope, it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. It was going to do everything. It was going to see to the edge of the universe. It was going to look at the eye of God and all sorts of things. After the launch, and when the problem with what's called spherical aberration, the telescope can't properly focus the light that comes into it, once that became discovered, then the press reaction was that it's a complete dud. It's doing nothing. Well, the reality is halfway between the two. And it's often the case that the press will polarize issues. And so one has a sense that sometimes things have totally failed when it's not necessarily the case. There are far more grays here than this black and white picture.
Give me a sense of the history, if not of the Hubble telescope, Robert Smith, then of just this, again, this large word, this large term that you're engaged in writing about, big science. We have to figure out an intermixture here of politics and science, cultural issues. How do we make our way through that maze?
Well, the problem is that the very bigness of big science means it engages all sorts of issues far outside of science. So, for example, with the Space Telescope, it wasn't simply a question of taking a design for a telescope, going to Capitol Hill and the White House and getting a yes, no, and you go off if they say yes and start building it. There was a whole political process that was engaged that went over several years, mm-hmm. during which the very definition of what the telescope would be, what it would do, who would build it, how it would be built, was actually up for grabs.
And that changes over time. I mean, it's not a fixed thing, is it?
Exactly. And that leads to some difficulties. And the great problem is, how do you end up with a program which has been approved right. by the White House and Congress that the engineers and astronomers can actually bring into being with a reasonable chance of success?
Have we lost completely, Robert Smith, the what this image, this notion of the lone scientist working in his or her laboratory? That's, you know, we got Dr. Frankenstein, mm-hmm. and then we move into the modern world. What?
I think that's been, it's still the case that you have individual scientists doing their thing. But the issue with big science is, in a way, that there is now vastly more big science than there's ever been.
Uh-huh.
There's always been, for the last few hundred years anyway, aspects of big science enterprises. If you look, even in the 16th century, you can find big science enterprises.
What would that be? What would that involve?
Well, one example would be an astronomer named Tycho Brahe, a Danish astronomer.
16th century.
That's right. Uh-huh. And in 1576, he started building a large, what you could call in modern terms, a research facility on an island between Copenhagen and Elsinore. Hmm. This island was granted to him by King Frederick II of Denmark. He built a very large observatory, which also had alchemical labs, a library, a printing press. He had, in effect, pre-docs working with him. He had computers.
Right.
Human computers.
Right.
He had observing assistants, mechanics to help build some very large instruments that he had there.
So the pattern that we're observing today really has a very long history to it.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
It's not a case that all of a sudden people learn, say, in World War II, how to do big science projects.
Right.
In a way, big science has been with us for a long time.
Is it always the government that acts as the patron in big scientific projects?
Almost invariably, that's the case now. Uh-huh. Although, for example, in astronomy, there's a long tradition of private philanthropists providing money for the biggest telescopes in the world. So, for example, at the moment, the Keck Observatory in Hawaii is being constructed, and the money for that was from the Keck Foundation.
That's private money.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And those are the largest ground-based telescopes.
Well, how do the scientists themselves talk amongst themselves about issues like this, not only in practical terms, but in ethical terms? I mean, what sense do you have, Robert Smith, as a historian of science, of the ethical sense of the scientists themselves?
Well, I think that many people would prefer not to pursue big science. But the question is, how do you do the things you can do with your big science tools?
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't do it with any other method, then in a way you're stuck with it, and you're stuck with all these kinds of things that go on.
So you make promises that you can't necessarily keep?
No, I think often the case is that people are asked to do things, and you think, well, we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Then a little bit later, it may be the case that you're told, well, we can't give you all this money. What if we took some of this away from your budget? And you convince yourself, well, okay, we'll do this and that and the other, we can carry on. But if this salami sort of tactics goes on for too long,
yeah.
you end up with a project where you simply can't meet your original objectives.
As you look at big science, again, you, Robert Smith, have spent part of your life as a historian living way back in the Middle Ages, looking at the origins of what we call big science. You're also engaged in things like the Hubble telescope and the superconducting supercollider. Is there a way to generalize and talk about the major peril, the major reward that our citizenry should be aware of?
Well, it's very hard to generalize about the different sorts of activities that we lump under the heading
mm-hmm.
of big science. Earlier big science projects weren't so perilous in the sense that people weren't putting all their eggs in one basket. And if things didn't work, well, okay, we've lost something, but we haven't lost everything.
Well, now that isn't science at work. That's politics at work.
But you can't separate science and politics when you start talking about big science. It's
uh-huh.
the two become inseparable. And I think the other side of that is that if people come forward to the Congress and the White House with projects and they're not being honest with their evaluations, and halfway through the project, it
right.
seems that they have to get a lot more money for the project to be completed, I think that the Congress and White House at that point should say, okay, we'll kill the project. Mm-hmm. But often the political constituencies are so powerful that that becomes impossible. So you have a structure where projects go in at a certain cost but end up costing much more. And I think that's really one of the major concerns that politicians have these days, as well as scientists themselves.
Mm-hmm. Robert, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. What's your responsibility as a science, as a historian of science? Does this keep you awake at night, or do you just sort of work through the details and then size up the project when it's finished?
To write the history as truthfully and honestly and accurately as I possibly can.
How do you do that? I mean, you talk with colleagues, you agonize over the evidence. Describe the process briefly for me.
Well, for modern topics, it means that one can actually go and talk with people who are engaged in building these kinds of instruments or using these kinds of instruments. So it means that I've been able to attend meetings, mm-hmm. I've been able to go to briefings on Capitol Hill, I've spoken with all sorts of different people involved on projects at a whole range of different levels, from NASA administrators, senators, all the way down to people working on the instruments in a very nitty, gritty sense. So in a way, for the modern projects, I have advantages that somebody in 50 years' time won't have. So I lose something in distance, but I gain something, I think, in immediacy and access to documentation.
Are the scientists themselves suspicious of people like you? Do they welcome your presence, your criticism, your feedback?
I think they welcome it. For example, the Space Telescope, which is the example I know best because that's the one that I've studied the longest, I was allowed after a while of following the Space Telescope project to sit in on the executive sessions that the scientists held. Nobody else could sit in on them, but I was able as a historian to sit there because they knew that I could be trusted and wasn't going to tell the Washington Post the next day what I said.
Well, Robert, I want to thank you for this lively and this fascinating overview of big science. Tell me very quickly, what's on your mind right now? What are you interested in?
I'm looking at the example of Greenwich Observatory in the 19th century, mm-hmm. a kind of proto-big science enterprise, large teams, lots of government money, and observations over many years. And so what I'm trying to do at the moment is tease out these links between astronomy in the 19th century and how it sets people up to do astronomy in the 20th century.
Well, Robert, it sounds fascinating. Again, I want to thank you for your participation on Soundings. Good luck in your work.
Thanks, Wayne.
Robert Smith is a professor of history at the Johns Hopkins University and research associate at the Smithsonian Institution. His most recent book is The Space Telescope, a study of NASA, science, technology, and politics, available from Cambridge University Press. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Philosophy and environmental ethics. Join me now for a conversation with philosopher and activist Tom Reagan of North Carolina State University.
I write of a new generation, the generation. It is a generation of service, of giving, not taking, of commitment to principles, not material possessions, of communal compassion, not conspicuous consumption. If the defining question of the present generation is, what can I get for me? The central question of this new generation is, what can I do for thee?
Philosopher and social activist Tom Reagan. Reagan is probably best known as the philosophical guru of the animal rights movement. His book, The Case for Animal Rights, was nominated for a National Book Award. Lately, he's interested in the philosophical aspects of cultural unity, cultural disparity, and the relation of such issues to the environment and the Earth's diminishing resources. Tom Reagan's latest book is The Generation, subtitled Reflections on the Coming Revolution. In it, he writes about a range of social topics, from pornography and feminism to animal agriculture and vivisection. He draws on the work of philosophers ranging from John Stuart Mill in the 19th century to one of his contemporaries, Paul Taylor. For example, Reagan acknowledges the tradition of utilitarianism, the greatest good for the greatest number, but he also argues for standing on the part of all sentient beings, not just humankind, in both the moral and natural worlds. Here's Tom Reagan.
Well, utilitarianism is the idea that what's morally right and wrong depends upon what produces the best consequences. So roughly, the right thing to do is what's going to bring about the best consequences.
We're talking about pleasure and pain. We're talking about where my fist ends and your nose begins, that sort of thing.
That's right. And normally, that is the way it's thought of in terms of what's going to make the world better.
Uh-huh.
And you can say interpret how you want to say what makes something better.
Where does the notion of the individual fall into this conversation? That is to say, when we try to figure out who's going to benefit, the number of beneficiaries, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, the number, I think, is going to vary from case to case, obviously. But what's important for any rights philosophy, as distinct from utilitarian philosophy, is that the individual is not to be thought upon merely as a resource for the good of others. And so remember, there's a tradition in moral philosophy that you find in Kant about humanity exists as end in itself, and we're never to treat human beings merely as means to ends, and so on. Well, that's crucial to any rights philosophy, including human rights philosophy. But what the animal rights philosophy is goes a step further, and you say you're not to do that to other animals either. So that what's important for our purposes, it seems to me, is to see that both the animal rights philosophy, which is a new kid on the block, as it were, and the utilitarian philosophy, which has its at least its 19th century ancestry, and actually goes back further than that, but that these two philosophies are alike in demanding a widening and extension of the moral community to include non-human animals, despite the fact that they differ so profoundly.
Uh-huh.
So what's interesting is that you have people marching to the drumbeat of utilitarianism, you have people marching to the drumbeat of animal rights, and they really are marching in certain sense to different drumbeats, obviously, because the philosophies are different, but at a certain crucial point, they come out the same. They are out there to protect animals.
All right. Now, are you the reconciler here, Tom? I mean, what are you doing as a moral philosophy when you look at these two strands? And do you move beyond them? How do you combine them? What's happening?
Well, what I personally try to do is try to argue for the animal rights philosophy. That's what I am. Not a utilitarian, and I disagree with the utilitarian philosophy across the board, it seems to me. But what's important, I think, in terms of my role as an educator, as opposed to my role simply as a in-the-street activist, which I'm not opposed to doing, but I mean in terms of an educator, is to try to talk to people and to say utilitarianism should be taken seriously. There's a lot we can learn from utilitarianism. Let's look at Bentham, let's look at Mill, let's look at Singer, let's look at the utilitarians, but also let's look at how this conversation is evolving, because it's not just these two ideas. There are other ideas we have to consider, and most importantly, let's not get caught up just in how we disagree with one another, but let's see where it comes out.
And the now points of harmony.
That's right. Where it comes out again is that, just as in the case of the utilitarian and the animal rights philosophy, what happens is that there are all these differences, but at the same time, what you want to say is we really shouldn't be trapping animals to put them on our backs. See,
uh-huh.
I mean, and so there's a point of convergence from these different streams. There's like this lake of agreement fed by these streams of dissension, if you know what I mean. So you have that. But Taylor's got another stream. His thought is coming from some other place, and there, it's in conflict with utilitarianism, in conflict with animal rights, and so on. But it's feeding the same lake of agreement.
All right, now
and that's what's forming the generation.
Let's get away from some of the paraphrases that that we're going through here of the work of other philosophers. I want to talk about what you believe in as a philosopher. Let me put a couple of words on the term here. Eco-holism. What
sure.
in the world does that mean?
Well, it helps because, see, one of the things about the utilitarian and the animal rights philosopher and Taylor's position is that despite all their differences, the one thing that they all say is individuals matter.
Uh-huh.
It's this individual being who's in pain, or this individual being who has rights, or this individual form of life for Taylor and so on. But individuals somehow are the coin of the realm when you're in the moral community. And what some people want to say is that is wrong-headed, that what we really need to do is to think about not individuals...
But the big picture.
But the big picture, the health of a system, not the welfare of individuals.
All right, now if we think about the big picture, who's going to make the decisions that affect the individuals that result in the big picture?
Well, presumably those will be the people in political power. That's always who makes decisions. But what an eco-holist wants to say is this, roughly, what we want to do, what we should be thinking about is what promotes the good of the community of life, and that's to say what promotes its sustainability, its richness, its diversity, its beauty, its integrity, its harmony, and so on. So that, for example, this is a very important illustration of the difference. I mentioned earlier about the idea that we shouldn't be trapping animals to put them on our backs and so on, like for furs and so on. But from an eco-holistic point of view, trapping animals for fur is fine, so long as you don't trap too many of them. And because if you trap too many of them, then the system gets out of balance, and then you have repercussions, and it's not sustainable, and so on and so forth. So they're the locus of value for an eco-holist, as the name suggests, is the whole of the eco-community of life. And there are significant differences then between an eco-holist and an animal rights person, or a utilitarian for that.
What we're doing here is breaking down the monolithic labels that have become attached to people who claim that they are for animal rights, that they are defending the rights of trees or whales or beavers or mockingbirds or little critters that live in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. How is the average citizen, Tom, to make his or her way through this vocabulary?
Well, I don't think the vocabulary is that intimidating. I mean, it seems to me that it's the role of the educator, of course, to explain what the options are. It's as though, see, you've come in and you've got an ailment, and I'm the doctor, and what I've got to do is say, well, you have this option, seems to me. Clearly, what we got is an ailment. It's called the ecological crisis, the environmental crisis. I mean, the world is in very bad shape, so far as I can see, in terms of water purity, air purity, loss of topsoil, loss of forest, and so on. It's not in good shape.
Let's use that as a springboard into what you call the generation, Tom Reagan. What does that mean to you? Is that just a term that you invented? What's going on?
Well, it is. It was something that I was trying to think about to respond to how... what I was finding in my life when I went to campuses and talked to campus audiences, especially young people, and what I was finding in these young people, not only young people, mind you, I mean, there are members of the generation who are even older than I am, as hard as that is to believe. But remember when St. Augustine talked about the city of God, it was not any particular place. The city of God is defined by the content of beliefs rather than some location.
Somewhere in the heart.
Yes. The generation is like that, too. It's not just an age matter. It's a question of a certain sense of values. What's partly definitive of this, then, is this notion that there is something to protect, something to speak for, something to help, someone to think and help and so on, who's not a human being. And that's what all this has in common. See, the utilitarians and the animal rights and so on, when all the dust settles, what you begin to realize is, my heavens, there's an assault upon Western traditions here. That's what's going on. Who's right, who's wrong, I'm not sure, but there is this, as I say, there are all these streams coming in here, but there is this sea of agreement, and that is that the anthropocentric boundaries of the moral community, that notion that the moral community begins and ends at the boundaries of our species, is no longer viable. And we're going to have to adjust to this as a society, because there's a whole generation of young people coming along who simply reject this. Gallup did a 1991 teenage youth survey. Does this every year. 2 out of every 3 teenagers in this country accept the goals of the animal rights movement. Now, never before in the history of Western thought has there been a generation coming along who thinks that animals are not ours to eat or to wear or to shoot or to hunt or, you know, I mean, there's something profoundly important happening. And what I'm trying to suggest to people is that it's not that change is coming from all sorts of sources, some of which are intellectual, some of which are the contributions of philosophers. That's not the whole story, but it's part of the story.
All right, here's a real quick footnote to our conversation, Tom Reagan, and give me a very quick answer. Are you basically optimistic about the kind of work that you do, that, you know, taking philosophy to the barricades when it comes to things like forests and daffodils and chickens and ducks and the animal world and the moral community? I mean, you got a lot on your plate there.
Well, I am optimistic. I mean, one has to be optimistic or else one would give up, obviously. I mean, so you one of the things that you're aware of is the terrible evils of the world. I mean, you're aware, and what's to be emphasized is that the evils that occur, there are children, and not just animals and trees and so on. There are women who are being battered. There are poor people who are being discriminated against. And the animal rights movement is part of this broad social justice movement. That really is what I try to make clear to people. Uh-huh. And so it's always the question about, is there hope or is there despair? And I always get up in the morning and vote for hope.
Tom Reagan, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Let me mention quickly your latest book here. It is The Generation, subtitled Reflections on the Coming Revolution. It is available from Temple University Press. You're a professor of philosophy at North Carolina State University and a former fellow of the National Humanities Center. Tom, it's always good to see you. Good luck in your work.
Thank you very much, Wayne. My pleasure to be here.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like to have an audio cassette of this week's show. My guests were historian Robert Smith of the Johns Hopkins University and the Smithsonian Institution, and philosopher Tom Reagan of North Carolina State University. Robert Smith is at work on a history of large-scale science and public policy. Tom Reagan's recent books include The Generation. For an audio cassette of their comments, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 685. That's number 685. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Include $2 if you'd like to have a complete catalog of Soundings discussions. Next week, the observations of an American literary scholar about her life in Japan. Join me for a conversation with Kathy Davidson of Duke University. Kathy Davidson will be here to talk about her book, 36 Views of Mount Fuji. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.